They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome in. Crossover Podcast. Last episode from the bubble. My watch has ended here in Central Florida. So I'll be headed home in the coming days. Looking forward to it. Great experience. I'll be writing about it over the course of this week. As always, subscribe, rate, review to this podcast. Pleased to be joined for the last episode in the bubble by a man still optimistic about the bubble, still, what is the phrase, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed about the bubble. Sam Amick does a great job covering the NBA and bubble life now for The Athletic. Sam, what's up, man?
Mannix, not feeling bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. You dragged me out of bed, and by bed, I mean 11 a.m.
I'm going to say, yeah. Like, could we be, like, for context here, I wasn't going to throw you under the bus, but you're, like, I'm texting you about this podcast a couple of days ago, and you're like, later the better. I'm like, well, what does he think late actually is? I'm like, 11? You're like, yeah, I guess I could do 11. Like, 11 o'clock?
Listen, the curse of working at a place that, you know, this is not my old newspaper life where I had deadlines. So the curse of The Athletic, and there aren't many, is you can take your time with what you write. And I'm guilty of doing that 9 times out of 10. And so every night, and I'm going to have to change this up because it's not sustainable, but I'm out here sitting by the lake with the laptop, and these are late nights, man. I mean, I'm wrapping it up at 3 a.m. roughly. And the adjustment too, because like you said, I'm new, been here on the inside, out of quarantine for about a week. And I mean, I'm coming off 6 months of 10 p.m. bedtimes and routine and no games. And so some culture shock, but I'm ready to take your torch and try to do it proud, Mannix.
Pick up the mantle.
Yes.
And by your sixth week, you'll be just as jaded as I am at this point.
You look pretty jaded right now.
Looking around going,
looking pretty jaded.
Oh, man. I'm at the point, too, like, you know, Dan Wojcicki, our friend for the LA Times, made the mistake of, like, indicating to me where his room was. So every time I walk past it, I slam on the window. Like, last night, and we're recording this over the weekend, I saw you late, probably close to 2 a.m. at some point, walk by Wojcicki's room, bang, 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 bang. Like, there's, I'm at that point where it's like, screw everybody.
This place is wild, man. It really is. It's like college dorms, you know, meets AAU tournament, you know, with a ton of rules in between, meets communist society. I mean, you know, Big Brother is watching.
You and I are in agreement on one thing where there are an extreme amount of rules, especially when it comes to where you can go and what you can do. And I don't blame, like, the NBA's got to, they put all this together on the fly. I just think it's sort of weird that I can spend the entire afternoon outside the Clippers meal room, but I can't, like, be on the golf course when they are because of what exactly? I'm not entirely sure. It's just, logic doesn't really apply to some of these things.
Right. And sometimes the reason, you know, the answers to the questions you're asking, like, they're not going to tell you, but they're not hard to figure out. There's a somewhat uncomfortable kind of class system thing in here because part of the players agreeing to come was having it be their way. And the union certainly bargained to get, you know, the rules the way they are. And I get it because if you're a player, even guys that we're friendly with, you know, they decided they didn't want to necessarily intersect with media and staff. And but, you know, there's a threshold there that folks like us, you know, especially when you're here 6, 7, 8, you know, 8 weeks, some people are here 3 months, you know, is going to make folks a little cranky.
You mean like Kyle Goon from the Orange County?
I'm worried about our boy.
Goon, who...
He got a long ways to go.
And had a fairly biblical rant the other day. We won't reveal all the specifics, but I think anybody within a block radius of the cafeteria here probably heard it. Shout out Kyle Goon, doing a good job for the OC Register. All right. I want to talk about some non bubble things, or at least past tense bubble things. And I want to begin with the biggest news of the week that had nothing to do with the bubble. And it was the Nets' decision to just pop out of nowhere and hire Steve Nash to be their next head coach. Nash, of course, been retired for several years now. He had been doing some work for Golden State, which I'm sure you saw some of, being out in the Bay Area as a player development consultant, just kind of parachuted in here in and out to work with guys. Now he's going to get an opportunity to coach not only an NBA team, but coach an NBA team with lofty expectations. So give me your reaction to the Nets' decision to hiring Nash.
I liked it. I was definitely surprised by it, stunned. It was not on my radar at all. You know, I've since learned a little bit more about how it came to be. And like the other day, I talked with Jared Dudley, his old teammate with the Suns. And, you know, sounded like when he talked to Steve after the hire that you know, it was at least a week, if not more, this thing had been growing. I like it because, for one, I have a really good sense of where Kevin Durant is at in his career. And, you know, have covered him a lot at OKC. And then the Warriors chapter, where they accomplished a ton, but man, did it end on a edgy note. And so in a weird sort of way, I was actually happy for Kevin to see that he's almost kind of pulling a little piece of that Warriors experience with him to the Nets, with a guy in Steve who he had become pretty close with. Even before that Warriors role that Steve had, Steve was a guy that Kevin respected, would occasionally talk to. Then next thing you know, they're working out. They're getting in the basketball lab, and Kevin learns firsthand how Steve's mind works. Steve's personality is, I think, great for a guy like Kevin. He's a fantastic communicator, a genius in terms of the game itself, can talk on Kevin's level. And, you know this, but when Kevin looks in the mirror, like he 100% doesn't think anybody can talk the game like him. He's incredibly confident on that front. So I like it a lot for Kevin because I think trust is something that he needs in his coach right now. The jury is going to be out on Kyrie. And at base value, it can't hurt that you have a point guard talking to a point guard. I think that's good. And then I definitely liked, and I wasn't around the Nets a lot the last couple of years, but by all accounts, you know, Jacques Vaughn just had a real impact on that group. And when you see guys like Garrett Temple, you know, old head vets who have seen a lot, done a lot, just absolutely vouching for him, Jamal Crawford, I think Jacques being there is huge too. So I liked it.
Yeah, I'll peel back a couple of things you said there. I agree that Jacques being there is invaluable. I mean, Jacques, for Kenny Atkinson early, was invaluable. I mean, Jacques had head coaching experience, and a lot of times early on, Jacques was running a lot of those practices because he knew Kenny had the developmental coach part of it down. Excellent developmental coach, but Jacques was more versed on kind of the day-to-day early, and he was a huge resource for Kenny. I think he'll be a huge resource for Steve Nash. And credit to Jacques for, you know, putting the ego aside there. I mean, he easily could have been in the mix for, you know, several of the head coaching jobs that are available. He could have taken a year off, and we've seen by guys just sitting out, their stock grows. You know, people start to think of them even more highly. But he's taking a well-paid assistant job, and he's going to be, you know, part of something there. And I think his stock will only grow with that group. You know, I gotta get past like all the initial positives that invariably come out, because I remember it with, and he's not the same player, but Jason Kidd had a lot of the same things. It was, you know, really smart former NBA point guard, well respected across the league by his peers. It didn't work out that way in Brooklyn. Now it's a different player and it's a different team, but I think you have to kind of cut through the positives and look at the risk. And Nash has never coached anything in his life, and he's going to a team where if you don't start like, you know, 20-5, like, people are going to be panicking. You're in New York. I mean, people are going to be reacting in a certain way. And Kyrie does worry me. I mean, Kyrie, we know that, you know, Kevin Durant and Kyrie were consulted on this decision. Presumably both were on board with it. We know Kevin Durant, to your point, has that good relationship with him. But Kyrie, if Kyrie thinks that you're not like on his sort of intellectual level, or if you're not coaching the game the way he thinks the game should be coached, he revolts. I mean, and we've seen him revolt, whether it was a want out of Cleveland for different reasons. He's the only player I know that's ever had an issue with Brad Stevens. Maybe Jared Sullinger is another one. But like the only, like being in Boston, Kyrie Irving was one of the very few players that ever had an issue with Brad Stevens. And Brad Stevens, I think we can both agree, one of the best X and O's coaches in the entire NBA. How does Kyrie react if he thinks he's not getting that same level of coaching or a high level of coaching from Steve Nash? I mean, Kyrie is, to me, a huge wild card in this situation.
Yeah, I hear all of that. I would draw a pretty distinct line, or, you know, distinction between Steve and Jason Kidd. To me, their personalities are very, very different. There is a kind of a all-for-one, one-for-all selflessness to Steve that honestly, as great as Jason was and certainly made so many guys so much money as a player, different communicators, different wiring. And I think Steve's ability to diffuse and to handle something like a Kyrie, you know, kind of firestorm, so to speak, is going to come in handy. But I hear all of that. And the scrutiny element that you're hitting on is 100% fair because, yes, it's New York. Yes, by the way, we can get into this, you know, down the line, but like not necessarily Steve's fault, but you're also now being looked at sideways because the trend of black coaches in the league continues to go in the wrong direction. So that's just going to add even more pressure. For me, I think media-wise, in terms of my reaction, if I'm being transparent, I was, you know, I'm framed by the fact that when the Warriors hired Steve Kerr, I was critical of it. You know, Mark Jackson had done some good work. Steve had never coached. So admittedly, you know, I've just decided, kind of fool me once, shame on you type thing. And I think this will work. And we've seen this before with guys who haven't done it. But, yeah, I mean, that spotlight's going to be hot.
It is. And look, it's somewhat strange for a couple of white guys to be getting into the kind of racial debate, so to speak. But
that's where we are, though.
I just scoffed at the idea that Steve Nash being hired was an example of white privilege. I do agree there need to be more black coaches, you know, for there just to be, you know, five or six in the NBA now and the league to be 80% black. You've got to have more black coaches, but this isn't white privilege. This is ex-player privilege.
And I'm not saying this hire is white privilege by any means, but I mean, it's gone from, I think, was it 14 back in 2012 down to 5. Mm-hmm. And you put that in the mood of this moment in the context of where the country's at right now and where the league's at right now.
I would say this, though, and by the time this podcast airs, maybe something has broken on it, but I do think that Ty Lue is the front runner for the Philadelphia 76ers job. He's going to get a job one way or the other, whether it's Philadelphia or New Orleans. That's one. I think Ime Udoka is a strong candidate for the Bulls job. I think Steven Silas is a strong candidate for the Bulls job. I think there's a number of coaches that are going to get those gigs very soon. So while in a big picture kind of way, absolutely, there need to be more black coaches in the NBA. I think you're going to see two, maybe three in the coming weeks that get hired. So I think that changes the mix as well. I think with Nash, it's just, we saw it with Mark Jackson, you know, a former player with no experience, you know, getting a head coaching job. We saw it with Jason Kidd. We've seen it with Steve Kerr. It just happens sometimes. It often happens with guards, like, you know, point guards, you know, where everybody just kind of looks at them as like,
it's funny,
generals.
The unique part is a lot of those guys you mentioned, you know, they were on TV all the time.
Yeah.
And the owners could hear the way they saw the game.
Owners should not be allowed to have any input into any decision whatsoever. Well, I'm sorry. Tough. Just having billions of dollars does not make you a basketball savant. I'm sorry.
Which doesn't. Is why when the Warriors hired Steve, you know, I heard that he had golfed with Joe Lacob. And you're just immediately going, oh, good Lord. Like, is this how this happened? And obviously, I got that one wrong. But with Steve, I think it's more genuine of what led to the hire because you have the personal tie with Sean Marks. You have the personal tie with Kevin Durant. And on the personal off-court side, I mean, Steve was a happy dude, and Steve did not have to take this job. Steve, as you know this, Steve would roll around Manhattan Beach. If you hung out in that part of the country, which is a beautiful part of the country, on any given day, you know, you might see him out there on the beach doing his thing. And Jared Dudley, again, had told me, he's like, the only place Steve was leaving, you know, other than Manhattan Beach, was for New York City. Because back in his playing days, had a house out there, loves New York. And so it checks both boxes for him. But you're not wrong. I mean, the first couple months of next season, whenever the hell they might be, are going to be very similar to the Heat when they got, you know, LeBron and D Wade and Bosch together, and Eric Spoelstra, and the way that, you know, he was kind of judged on a daily basis. It's going to be real, also because we've been waiting for so damn long for this team because of the injuries. You know, like, it was a story a year ago, and now we finally will get to see what it looks like, and a lot of that's going to be Steve.
Steve is Canadian, so he's familiar with cold winters, but he spent a lot of his adult life in Phoenix, in Los Angeles, right, in Manhattan Beach. I'm curious how he enjoys New York in January.
Real quick, before you move on, yeah. I should have gone down this road a second ago. Your question about Kyrie makes me think of, I was around those Lakers teams a lot when Steve had, you know, a really tough time with the Lakers, back problems, couldn't get healthy, you know, the team that never was, you know, Kobe and Dwight Howard and that group. I will say, to the question of conflict resolution and management, I don't know what I think of what I saw of him during that time, because it felt like, you know, he was kind of the kid between the two parents. He didn't necessarily have the answers to kind of fix the friction between Kobe and Dwight. Again, not an apples to apples comparison, but I remember at the time thinking how interesting it was, because I had seen him up close in the Phoenix days when it was harmonious and it was basketball utopia and they all loved each other, and Mike D'Antoni and Steve were just like the basketball marriage. And then the Lakers thing was very different. And in that environment, Steve didn't necessarily have the answers for some of these personal dynamics that did help drag them down.
No, that's a good point. I remember Mike D'Antoni, what was it, the day after they knock off Oklahoma City and the Steve Nash hire gets announced, like, nobody's going to ask Mike about the Lakers. Nobody's going to want to talk about the Lakers. Right. It's just, you know, Steve Nash as a head coach. Right. Before I put a button on this topic, you mentioned Mark Jackson, and you followed him pretty closely in the Bay Area. He has not only not been hired since 2013, he hasn't really gotten a whiff of a job since 2013. A few interviews here and there, but nothing that's come close. You know, we've seen people on TV say, why isn't Mark Jackson getting hired? What's your take on that?
I think the Warriors chapter and the way it ended, and all it takes is for one owner, one team, one GM to just decide they don't care about this. But the infighting that happened at the end with him and the Warriors was not good. Now, some of it, to be totally honest, I think, a lot of it falls on the Warriors. You know, they lost trust with Mark and felt as if he was kind of, and you see this with really, really kind of, just coaches with a certain type of personality. When Tom Thibodeau saw the end in Minnesota, you know, he put his walls up and didn't want anybody looking at his practices. And you start getting real cagey. Michael Malone in Sacramento did that a little bit. And Mark, you know, got very territorial during the end of the Warriors days. Trust was a major issue. You know, we remember the story about him, getting recorded by Darren Erman. And that was a product of, you know, what was happening between those human beings. You know, Bob Myers was looking at Mark Jackson sideways. Joe Lacob was looking at Mark Jackson sideways. So that stuff, I just think, has been a red flag. And then on the basketball side, I feel bad for Mark, because they got a lot accomplished. But when history, you know, tells you that you had a group of players who was capable of one thing offensively, but when you had them, you know, there was a ceiling of sorts on what you were able to accomplish. And then once you kind of changed the code with the way that Steve decided to run the team, it went off to, you know, a level that was up there with some of the best teams of all time. You know, that doesn't end up reflecting great on Mark on the offensive side. But he established a defensive culture with their group. That was huge. The Warriors did not play defense back in the day. You know, the Andrew Bogut trade sparked all that stuff. So he did a lot of good work. I just think there's, you know, the red flags kind of remain around the league.
Yeah, there are a lot of layers to Mark Jackson, but you're right with the politics of it. I don't, you know, GMs, when I talked about Mark Jackson, the reaction's often like, you know, they don't want to get into an us versus them kind of thing. They don't want, you know, it to, you know, Mark to be in a position where he could galvanize the locker room one way and it could turn out to be adversarial. It's just, for some GMs that have considered him, that's the response I've gotten, that it's just not worth the headache. And the other part of it, too, is, I mean, I don't know that Mark's done himself any favors. And look, there's a big paycheck that comes with being on TV. but there's also big advantages to going into the assistant ranks. I know it's a bit of an ego check there, but look, we saw Ty Lue, sit on Doc Rivers' bench, and that's a unique situation because Ty and Doc are so close, and Ty knew what he was getting into. But if Mark thought there were flaws in his coaching style, I mean, go work for somebody and better yourself and become a better head coach. Just an education that you can't get from, sitting courtside and calling games with Mike Breen and Jeff Van Gundy. You just can't get it. So I honestly think if Mark had done that, maybe not right after, but in the 7 years that have passed, joined the bench of some coach that he liked or respected or worked with him, I think there's a pretty good chance we'd have seen Mark Jackson back in the NBA, but he's decided that it's not the route he wanted to go. And I can't blame him because the paycheck's probably huge with ESPN right now.
No, I agree. He's an alpha male, and he wants things his way, and that often is only allowed once you've accomplished a certain amount. You know what I mean? Greg Popovich can do whatever the hell he wants. Even Brad Stevens at this point, guys like that where the coaching resume is longer. There was a moment recently on one of the playoff calls where Van Gundy said to Mark, they were talking about the mental health of the players out here and the Paul George situation and how confidence can be an issue. And I remember laughing because Jeff asked Mark, and he was being genuine, like, Mark, this is real. We've seen players who they just can't seem to find it. Is this something you ever dealt with as a player? And he just kind of scoffs and was just like, no, I didn't. It was a little bit of that air of like, you take that element and you put it into his coaching life, and there was some of that. Like, I'm running the team the way I run it because I don't question myself ever. And that has value, but it also doesn't open you to, an inclusive kind of, all for one, again, going back to that phrase, type of mentality. And I think that's a problem for these owners and these GMs who want a voice. That, I think, is the concern. Can our voice be part of this too?
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's talk about two teams that are out of the bubble and with interesting futures. I want to start with Utah. Back in March, a lot of problems within this team. The Gobert-Mitchell dynamic has been discussed ad nauseum at this point, but it did seem in the bubble that those two reconciled to a degree, that their difference were passed to my people within the Jazz organization, and maybe they're trying to speak it into existence to a degree, but they said that things were great between those two guys, and Mitchell and Gobert publicly seem to have put it behind them. Now we kind of spin it forward. Like, we assume that Mitchell will be in Utah under a max contract type of deal that almost always happens with these guys. Gobert, you kind of assume that they'll come to some kind of financial agreement. He won't get a supermax type of contract, but in an extension, it might be worth it for Gobert to take $30 million guaranteed per year or four, something like that. All that being said, when you look at the Jazz, what do you see as a ceiling on this team? You've got two guys that are really good. Mitchell, I think, is only going to get better, and I think the Dwayne Wade comparisons are apt. He could become a Dwayne Wade type of player. Gobert is 28 years old, still, despite not winning Defensive Player of the Year, still the guy you have to game plan for every single night when he's out there, a dominant defensive force. But this team doesn't have a ton of cap flexibility. You've got Mike Conley under contract for $34 million next year. You've got, Joe Ingles is still there. Maybe you re-sign Jordan Clarkson. When you look at the Jazz, do you look at that? This is a team that, are you bring the band back together and they're a threat to win the West, or are they still a cut below the top-tier teams of the conference?
I think they're still a cut below. I loved what I saw out of Donovan, both before I got here on TV and then when I was here. He took a jump, man. I mean, this was superstar type stuff. And the way he approached the game, and honestly, what will stick with me was I was at the arena when they lost Game 7 to the Nuggets, and man, that kid cares so much. I talked to him briefly on the way out. This moment that also sticks out in my mind, he was hugging Johnny Bryant, the Jazz assistant coach that is very dear to him. And, you see the way guys react to loss and failure, and you get a sense of who they are. So Donovan, I'm all in. I'm all in on the Donovan-Rudy pairing because I'm with you that it seems like they've mostly fixed what they have. And I love that Rudy's been honest and continues to say it's not perfect. You know what I mean? But I don't know how you stray away from those two guys as your core. From there, that's where things get tough because the Mike Conley addition has not paid off the way they thought it would. He had some good moments, in the bubble, But that's
you're just rooting for that shot to go in though.
Oh
at the
my
end.
God!
I mean, you don't like to root for, but Mike's such an easy guy to root for.
He is. He's a wonderful dude. I talked to Quinn Snyder after that game, and he made a comment about how he's like, with everything that happened, going back to March, them being the team that kind of, you know, had Rudy Gobert as patient zero and all the drama, even the story we wrote about all the internal dynamics that were going on, he says it felt like that shot should have fallen, like that's what needed to happen, and then it didn't. And it rims out, and now they got to retool and figure out what they want to do. I don't know. I mean, their pieces, like I can't find a piece that I'm down on, but then I see teams like Miami and Boston with the length and the athleticism and the speed, and that's where I think they're falling short, because you know the defensively they took a step back this year. That's a problem. Bojan Bogdanović is a very nice piece, and certainly it was not good at all for them to lose him coming out here. So I don't know what the addition is, but yeah, I do think they're a tier below.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bogdanović was badly missed. Like, you take a 20-point per game scorer off that team. I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to say if they have Bogdanović, I think they win that series against Denver. I think that it takes so much pressure off of Donovan, especially the first game of that series. It went for 50-plus, and, you know, they lost that game. But does Bogdanović coming back put them on the same level as the Clippers, the Lakers, and even the Warriors, who are going to be, you know, probably among the elite again next year? They can beat anybody. They can lose to anybody. Maybe you can say that about every team in the conference.
There's parity right now.
There's a lot of parity there. But the West, who's the worst team in the Western Conference next year? Is it Minnesota? San Antonio?
No. Say, you forgetting where I live?
I have like, don't. But are we trending?
And Sacramento, by the way.
Sacramento, is like, they're trending upwards to a degree, right? Like they're kind of... I mean, supposedly. I mean, De'Aaron Fox is great. I don't know. The point is, like, it's a fight every single night. There's no gimmies in the Western Conference next year.
Phoenix, what they did out here.
Yeah, you Phoenix know? Is going to get better. I think for the Jazz to get better, it's not going to come in free agency. They're not going to get a guy that's going to move the needle. It's got to be internal development with Mitchell taking that next step. And it's got to be, you know, they've been very good at the draft in recent years. Remember, Gobert was, 27th the year he was drafted? I mean, you've got to hit on one more, like, wingy scorer type, like a Clarkson but better, that can come off your bench and give you 25 minutes a night scoring the ball.
Well, I think of the Heat, and I'm not around them that much because of my being West Coast based, so I've really enjoyed seeing them up close. And you talk about the draft, it's like, my God, Tyler Hero, Duncan Robinson, Bam Adebayo. Are you kidding me?
Mid-round and undrafted guys in the case of Duncan Robinson.
And this, somebody from the NBA said this, our buddy Tim Frank from PR side was like, when's the last time that a team, you know, it wasn't a free agency thing. I mean, Jimmy comes their way, but then after that, they're capped out. And they do that trade for Iguodala and for Jay Crowder that was obviously huge. But it's the draft that is, you know, the core of what they became pre-Jimmy. And that's what the Jazz have to do. They got to hit. As an aside, this was also on my mind watching the Jazz-Nuggets series. It was fun because you know this. You remember, you know, Denver definitely missed on not drafting Donovan. And so, you know, you're watching Donovan almost take them out and just doing incredible things. But to your original question, I just don't know how you get away from Donovan and Rudy. It's a special combo as long as the personal dynamics are still, you know, salvageable.
Yeah, a lot of pressure on Dennis Lindsay, Justin Zanuck, those guys who've done a great job up until this point, you know, to find that extra piece in the draft or undrafted free agent, the Duncan Robinson type that can give them some strength there. All right, I want to talk about Oklahoma City for a second. Great year for Oklahoma City. No expectations coming into this season, and they showed out. I mean, they made the sixth seed in the Western Conference. Chris Paul was brilliant for them at age 35, making the All-Star team. He was a good player. He was a great mentor. I mean, he was everything they could have asked for and more. I think he was worth every nickel of his contract this year to that team. But now as you look ahead, like, it's a little bit unclear what direction they want to go. I'm sure you saw the Chris Paul video that he put on his Twitter account. Sam, that felt like a goodbye video to me.
It did.
That was like, and I've heard from people in Oklahoma City that have been like, no, he's just sort of, you know, thanking the city and the community. I'm like, that, he said, I don't know what the future holds. Like that felt like a goodbye video to me. I reported this past week that I don't think it's a slam dunk that Billy Donovan comes back. I think Billy is going to want to know what the direction of this team is before he signs on for three or four more years. I mean, he took over a team in 2015 that had Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant. Now he's coaching a team that is going to have who exactly? Good young pieces. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, excellent. Dennis Schroeder, excellent. Lou Dort, you know, that's talk about hitting in undrafted guys. Yeah, Lou Dort's a player. I don't know what the direction is of this team. What do you see from Oklahoma City in terms of priorities, you know, the direction that Sam Presti might go with this team this summer?
Now, I'm with you on all of that. I just don't have any clarity about Chris and the market, because when he first went there, Miami was the move. You know, Sam Presti was in touch with Chris's agent, Leon Rose, and they were definitely amenable to moving Chris at that time if that's what he wanted. And ultimately, that doesn't happen. Ultimately, to Chris's credit, he absolutely makes the best of what seemed to be a challenging situation, an unexpected trade. But I don't know, now that the Miami thing doesn't appear to be in the cards, you know, I don't know who's coming after Chris. So that's number one. As great as he played, I mean, I don't know if you have any ideas. I mean, where does he fit?
I have thought Minnesota for a while, but that's out of the equation with D'Angelo Russell there. To your point about Miami now is not doing anything until the summer of 2021. Like, they're not taking on any kind of contract. I don't see a natural fit.
Or giving up any of those pieces.
No, I don't see a natural fit from him out there. I don't see it. I don't know who it would be at this point. Could Dallas take? No, why would they want to pair Chris Paul with
Luka?
I'm just thinking of teams that might have some flexibility.
I mean, the Lakers would love him, but there's no way to get that deal done.
Lakers just tap themselves out of every asset they possibly have.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. And I'm not sure how Chris Paul feels about, you know, it's one thing to do it for 1 year. Does he want to, you know, spend the twilight of his career in a situation where you can win because you're good and you've got a good coach and good pieces around you and a good GM, but are you going to win the highest level? That's the question. Will Chris Paul have the same attitude for the next 2 years that he had this year?
Right. And then that's going to be the domino, and we see if it falls or not. And that could impact Billy Donovan and what he wants to do. Because I'm with you. You hear stuff about Billy right now. For one, I'm happy for him, because when he had Russ and when Russ was in, you know, the MVP year, there was this growing narrative that Billy Donovan couldn't coach like we thought he could. Mm-hmm. And Russ was, you know, basically running that team, and Billy was kind of on the side. And Billy just coached his backside off this year. And what he did with those lineups and using Dennis Schroeder and Shai and Chris together, you know, as we know, like the best trio in the entire league when it comes to net rating. It was fun to watch. And they almost pulled it off against Houston. But that's where Sam Presti is going to do what he does very well, which is to sit in a room for long amounts of time with these people and talk about what they want to do. And he, you know, Sam is a listener. He is not just, you know, a pound the table, this is how I'm going to run the team guy. He's going to want to know what Billy wants. And if Billy wants a new challenge, then I guarantee you Sam will listen. And if Chris wants a new challenge, he's going to listen, but he's going to be a killer when it comes to what he gets back for it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, that one seems to me, you know, really up in the air.
Yeah, and with Chris Paul, the Thunder have never been like, we're going to give him away. Like, they want something back in return.
Big
like
time.
They could have given
this
him away.
This isn't like doing a favor for a future Hall of Famer thing.
No. They're going to get something back if they trade Chris Paul. I don't know, have a feeling one way or the other what happens with Billy. I lean towards him not coming back just because there would have to be a pretty clear plan presented to him, I think, to get him to come back. And look, he's going to have like maybe not this year, but he'll have options as a coach. And who knows? Maybe he wants to go back to college. I don't know. I mean, he's one of the most successful college coaches of this generation. I mean, he's won a national championship. I think the market for him at a high college level, whenever college basketball gets untracked, would be robust. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've heard some of the rumors of Billy in college in the last couple of years. I think that could be a possibility as well. I think it's all the conversation he has with Sam in the next couple of weeks about the direction of this team. They are going to that's going to be the influencer right there. If Bill, I'm sure if Billy hears something that makes a lot of sense to him, he'll want to be back. If not, I think he I think they could part ways, and from there, who knows
right
where they'll.
I agree.
All right, let's finish with just a thought on Giannis. As we're recording this, the Bucks are down 3-0, and this will post after Game 4. But did you go into this postseason thinking that the outcome of this weird bubble playoff would have a massive impact on Giannis's future? The way some have thought that, all right, you know, they lose, they got to trade Giannis. Giannis turns down the extension, he's out. Or did you have a different perspective on it? Like, how did you view, you know, the result of this postseason and the influence it would have on the future of Giannis Antetokounmpo?
It would be the former for me, the idea that this would impact his decision. If you go back to the 2019 playoffs, I mean, ESPN, Malika Andrews dropping that story minutes after they lose to Toronto about how it's basically finals or bust next year in terms of the way Giannis sees his situation. That was kind of from – we've been doing this long enough that it's the media element that kind of led to that is like, whoa, okay. So that's the message that they're sending. And it was real, you know what I mean? And even though Giannis was upset about it at the time, you know, there was some – it was real. It was 100% real. I also have a very strong sense that on the Milwaukee side, if you come to present day now, I just think that hypothetical of him turning down the deal – if you ask me what reaction I think that would inspire, I think it's very possible that they would then take calls because...
So you don't think he's too big to trade?
I don't, no. I think, and I'm not saying 100% at all, but I do think that it would be a kind of chills down the spine moment for the Bucks that compels them to take calls. And I don't know what guides their mentality. I was thinking about the history. Okay, you know, that franchise has seen, you know, Kareem leave back in the day. And there's no context there. That's how I see it. And we're not even to the conference finals yet. And this is an absolute disaster for them. And more importantly, it's the Mike Budenholzer situation. I don't normally get irritated by post-game media stuff, but Giannis and Bud both, just that part of me that's competitive, I want to interrupt the presser and say, can we stop with the cliches? Stop with the we're fine. I mean, it's literally like that meme with the fire.
Everything is fine.
Everything is fine.
Well.
And Giannis,
Kevin Bacon at the end of Animal House.
It's insane.
Remain calm. All
and
well.
Like, and I don't know. Give me your take on this because, you know, last night as I was burning the midnight oil again and trying to put a story together, like I did kind of go down the road of the old school, like it's the damn playoffs, play more. You know, Giannis has averaged 35 minutes a game in these playoffs. Bud had a quote last night that I couldn't believe came out of his mouth where he said that when you're competing, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is close, when you're competing at this level in the playoffs and this intensity, that 35, 36 minutes is the ceiling. And you call it a ceiling. And so I instantly jump over to Basketball Reference and say, oh, let me look at some of these all-time playoff leaders. You know, Wilt Chamberlain averaged 47 minutes a game in the playoffs. LeBron, to make it more current for his career, has averaged 41 minutes a game in the playoffs. You know, Damian Lillard, I think Westbrook's on that list too. I know Giannis is struggling, but you just can't convince me that he shouldn't be out there a whole lot more than he is, and I don't quite understand why, especially in desperate times, you know, that hasn't been the case.
That was a fairly bonkers quote that, you know, 35, 36 minutes is his max. And you want to go, like, even more recent. Toronto, in a do-or-die situation against Boston, pushed Kyle Lowry out there for 46 minutes.
Right.
Kyle Lowry's 34 years old.
But more importantly, what does it say about Giannis that he continues to simply say, I will do what Coach Bud tells me to?
Yeah.
And I've always, I don't want to sound like a hypocrite because I've enjoyed the hell out of covering Giannis, have written glowingly about the way he's wired, his personality. He's such a kind person. But sports-wise, I'm looking at this series like, yeah, man, I don't know. Because this dude, Jimmy Butler over here, isn't about to just say, I do what Coach Spo tells me to do.
No.
Like, he's going to have a voice, and he's going to speak up. And there is an intensity and a fire that I'm not seeing out of Giannis. And I get it. He's frustrated. He's seeing this wall. He's not sharing it, but I guarantee you he's got thoughts about the coach. I mean, I'm not making a personal thing, but just the way that things are functioning right now and not functioning. He has those thoughts. He's not sharing them. But his vibe is in such stark contrast to Jimmy. And Jimmy, it's not in a vacuum. Jimmy is igniting that entire team. I mean, to hear Bam Adebayo last night talk about Jimmy, it's just a love affair. Mm-hmm. And it's a contagious spirit that, you know, Giannis is the MVP. I feel guilty when I'm not a hot take dude. I don't crack on people that often, but it is what it is. He's the MVP, and that contagious spirit is not there. The leadership is not there, and it's a lot of shrugging, and, you know, we're trying our best, which is just not good enough at this point.
We've seen both of us star players at times, like during games, tell their coaches to bug off when they're trying to
bug off.
Out.
Is that what they say, Maddox?
I'm trying to keep it PG. But like the metaphorical middle
bug off,
finger,
bud.
You're not sending in, you know, Dante DiVincenzo to come in, come get me or what?
Right.
You're not making a substitution here. Like Giannis has to do that. He's likely going to be the 2-time MVP. And you have to take a stand in those situations.
Although here's what's crazy, and now I'm going to just be kind of an idiot and just go full circle and argue with myself. Steph Curry, like, it's kind of similar to Steph, but Steph, like, you know, like 2-time MVP. I mean, Steph had moments when, you know, he would handle conflict the same way when he would fall in line and say, I'm going to do, you know, what Coach Jackson tells me or Coach Kerr tells me. So there's not one way to skin a cat, so to speak. But right now, in both of these series that we saw last night, it's just a reminder for me that good old-fashioned, and you're the dude who covers boxing so well, good old-fashioned intensity and meanness, and I've decided that I'm going to destroy you. Like, that works in basketball, too. And the Heat are doing that, and the Rockets did it in the game we saw last night. And Giannis and his group don't appear to have that right now.
And what's got to scare you from Milwaukee is that if you get beat in the second round, it's hard to make a case to Giannis that you can improve the roster because you don't have a lot of flexibility. You don't have a ton of assets to turn around and trade and get you the guys you need to have. Now, some of it's not necessarily on Milwaukee. Giannis has not played well in this series. No. So it's at some point you've got to look in the mirror and say, I'm not doing enough to get my team to the next level. But
his plus minus last night, by the way, not to get all geeky on you, but was 26 points lower than Jimmy's.
It's bonkers. Like, he's not playing well in this series. So I don't know how they turn around and say, all right, don't worry, we'll make things better. I mean, I guess you can replace the coach, but I'm not sure how that's going to work. I do think, you know, somebody said this to me when we were having a conversation about Boston, and it came up in the context of Milwaukee. Like, Milwaukee's got great depth, right? We all made a big deal about how they signed Marvin Williams, and it's like, great, you look at it, you can go 11 deep. You don't need to go 11 deep in the playoffs. You need to go 7 deep in the playoffs. You need to play your guys 38 to 40 minutes a game, and screw your depth. Your depth is there for foul trouble at this point. And, you know, Mike Budenholzer has not adjusted to that. He continues to play a fairly deep rotation and stick with his principles, which is take Giannis out at, like, the 5 or 6 minute mark in the first quarter, reinsert him in the second, keep him right around 30 to 33 to 34 minutes per game. Throw that out the window. Like,
to be fair, the other mystery of that, and again, this is a little dated when the pod's coming out, but like, the, you know, he turns the ankle.
Yeah.
And he did limp out of the building. Yeah. I watched him limping.
But even before that, the first two couple of games, we're still on the same sort of track, you know.
Again, I keep making the Warriors parallel. Reminds me a little bit of 2014-15. The Warriors almost got kind of bit by the fact that, like the Bucks, these past couple of years, they had been so dominant during the regular season that Steph would sit in fourth quarters. You know, their margin of victory was just through the roof. And then when they got into the postseason, you saw a team that didn't necessarily know how to operate in close games. And they got pushed more than they should, you know, with Cleveland in the finals, and then kind of got lucky when Kyrie gets hurt and all that stuff. But you see that where you have to adjust, and you're right. If I'm Bud, I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and put that playoff hat on and roll these guys out there and let them either do it or don't do it, you know. Before yesterday's game, one of the Bucks assistants rolled by, and this is innocent enough, I can say. It was Darvin Ham, and Darvin rolls by. I say hello, and And I said, "How you know, y'all going to bounce back tonight?" And he said, "Well, we're going to see what we're made of." You know, and that quote was in my head after the game, where it's like, damn. I mean, Chris, 41-13 in the fourth quarter. And again, like, forget about just that game. That's a statement about a team, that you would let that happen at this stage. Your entire track of your plan, your organization, this group is on the line, and you drop a 41-13 egg. It's remarkable.
It really is. Before I let you go, you talked to Jimmy Butler for a great piece in The Athletic this past week, and you know, watching Jimmy do what he does, it startles you to think of how many teams just gave up on him. Like Chicago, like, all right, we're good. Minnesota, you know, even though Tibbs tried to side with Jimmy with all that, they decided to trade him. Philadelphia makes what I think is going to turn out to be the most catastrophic decision in the process era by allowing Jimmy to walk and giving Al Horford $100 million, giving Tobias Harris $158 million. And now he's here in Miami, and he's doing everything that we kind of thought he was capable of. I mean, is Miami just the right fit, or were teams just wrong on Jimmy Butler, especially Philadelphia? I mean, that's the one where they're a Kawhi Leonard shot. I've said this before in this podcast. They're a Kawhi Leonard shot from maybe advancing to the conference finals, and they decide, yeah, you know what? We're going to just shake the team.
Right. I don't know the answer to that question, because on the one hand, it's obviously a disastrous mistake by Philly. But the specific question of, you know, could Jimmy have been unlocked and unleashed like this anywhere else? I don't know, because, we've now learned more about the Brett Brown dynamic in Philly. And I don't think, like, you hear Jimmy talk about how in Miami, I'm with a bunch of dogs. I'm with a bunch of people like Pat Riley, who are just the godfather, the OG, and they get up at 3 a.m. to practice just like I do. And that is the key and the X factor to what has happened in Miami. I don't know what it would have looked like in Philly, because that dynamic with Brett was not what this dynamic is with Spo. And, you know, I wrote last week about how essentially Philly didn't want Jimmy. I think he still could have gotten the max, but they didn't want him to talk to anybody else. Like, have you met the guy? Like, you're going to just tell him to not, you know, his first real huge opportunity in free agency, and he can't talk to anybody? So that sends a message that, like, we're not sure we want you. And that's what he wanted, was to be wanted. So I don't know, because it's easy now to say everybody messed up. But, man, the Clippers were lukewarm on, like, there was a Kawhi-Jimmy scenario that could have been in play. Mm-hmm. And quietly on the Clippers side, there was some, like, it was almost like that when you got a buddy who you like quite a bit, but then they bring a friend and you're not sure how you feel about the friend. There was some of that, you know, like, I guess if we got a stomach Jimmy to get Kawhi, then we will. But they, you know, they weren't sitting here saying, oh, Jimmy Butler is destined for greatness, you know, and other teams too. So I don't know, but I sure am enjoying, man, this Pat Riley Jimmy thing is just too much.
It's Miami might be, I don't want to say they're unique, but they're one of the very few teams that embraces internal conflict.
Yeah.
Like most teams want to
Which is very Kobe-esque, by the way.
Yeah.
And I love.
Most teams want to keep things as even-keeled as possible, as little drama as possible. Miami, I don't think they, embrace drama, but they don't really care that much about it. I think it kind of sharpens them to a degree. It's something that was present during the LeBron years. I mean, LeBron, it's pretty, he basically tried to run Eric Spoelstra out pretty early on, and Spoelstra's kind of like, I'm here, I'm not going anywhere, we can either get past this or, we can do something else.
Right.
But, they don't have a problem with Jimmy bad-mouthing somebody or Jimmy even going after a coach. They don't care. Like, they think this is all part of a successful team. And I'm sure that begins with Riley and what he kind of experienced with Magic in the 80s and then the Knicks in the 90s and then the Heat in the early part of this century. But they're built for Jimmy.
Yeah.
Like, they're the franchise that embraces everything Jimmy has to offer. If he wants to get a little surly outside of the court, even in between the lines, fine. But as long as he produces, they don't give a shit.
But at
they
least he's not, this is not a diva situation where he's doing it for himself. I mean, these dudes rock with him in the kind of way that you don't often see. You know, Bam last night makes a definitive statement that we had the best player on the floor. Mm-hmm. you know, the MVP is also in that game.
Don't forget, Myers Leonard said the same thing. Let's
right,
go. Let's go
right.
Myers Leonard.
Yes.
Shout out Myers Leonard. Get some minutes.
By the way, Jimmy's so – he's intense, and don't get it twisted. He can be an absolute, jerk too. And we saw that in Minnesota. He's fire and ice all the time. And, you know, Myers was doing his media last night, and I forget the question that came his way, but Jimmy was in the corner waiting to do his media, and actually, I was sitting there. We were both on our phones next to each other, and our buddy Chris Haynes from Yahoo Sports actually sent me a picture of this, and I've never felt like a smaller human being standing next to Jimmy. I looked really small. But Jimmy's waiting. Myers fields this question. Jimmy didn't like the question, and he mumbles to himself, "Man, tell him to shut the F up. That's what you do. That's what you do." Like, he's pep-talking Myers Leonard from 15 feet away during a press conference that he's not part of. And by the way, it's a player who doesn't play, you know, that much. Mm-hmm. So he has worked, man. And, you know, after that first game, I knew the Bucks were in trouble when Jimmy walks off the floor, looks up at the Tier 2 stands, and sees Pat Riley. It was his first playoff game in this entire bubble experience. And, man, it was so cool. I just got lucky. And Jimmy points up at Pat. Pat points to Jimmy. It reminded me, I forget the movie, but it's the old Robert De Niro line where we and Billy Crystal, where they're pointing at each other going, "No, you, no, you, you're the one." I mean, these guys are putting something special together. And yeah, I mean, a lot of other teams obviously missed the boat on Jimmy.
I feel like I saw that Major League too with Wesley Snipes and Charlie Sheen doing
right
to each other.
Here's the best part, and our other friend, so Tom Haberstroh from NBC Sports sends me a note. You have these moments as a writer when you try to do your best, but maybe you kind of botched a possible moment. So as I tried to write that moment, what I didn't pick up on at the time that's pretty funny is that what Pat actually said when he pointed at Jimmy was he yelled. He says, "You're making my dreams." And so I wrote it. It was good color. Well, Tom sends me a note. He says, "Yo, you missed it." He goes, "That was Pat referencing the Michelob commercial that that Jimmy did, where the Hall & Oates song is playing, yeah, and says, 'You're making my dreams come true.'" I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
You
know, by the way, to bring it full circle, is there Miami's a contender for Giannis in 2021 if
right
he hits unrestricted free agency? Is there any better sales pitch than what they're doing in the series?
I know.
Like,
and we've seen
they
that
don't even need to talk to him. Like,
I know.
Just send him tape of what right they're doing in this series.
Well, it's a little Kevin Durant Warriors-ish. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? With that conference finals where they almost got the Warriors, and next thing you know, he's putting the jersey on. So, yeah. And that's the power of Pat Riley. And you know, Pat's got to be loving the fact that with Jimmy in particular, as amazing as Pat's resume is, all of us, like, get dated. All of us need kind of a refreshing to remind the world that you still matter. And so there's young dudes who are 20 years old who have probably never heard of Pat Riley. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, Jimmy's running around like his publicist telling every player in the league that, you know, this dude is different from everybody else. And Giannis certainly knows that at this point.
Yeah, it'd be wild to watch in the months to come. Sam, appreciate the time doing this podcast. I'll be sleeping for the next couple of weeks, but I look forward to your dispatches from down here. And like, take before and after pictures. Like, take a picture when you go back to your room today. And
is this the after that I'm looking at?
This is basically the after. Yeah. I mean, I have worn these pants for, I think, 53 straight
days. That's my favorite.
It's I'm going to wear them tonight to the last round of games I'm going to, and I'll have them on the plane when I go back to.
I do need to thank you, because I'm half kidding. You've been an inspiration, because I was trying to figure out what to wear to games. Now, granted, last night I wore pants because it was raining, but you inspired me to realize that I can live my best life, wear shorts, wear t-shirts to these games. We're just rolling differently out here. I do the pants 60 days in a row. I don't know about that, but I won't even throw you under the bus and share the drawers comment you made when I asked you about it.
It's pretty loose. It was funny, the first night of games, you know, we mentioned Kyle Goon, there were a couple others that were wearing like suits. I think Tim Reynolds wore a suit as well.
And did you put an end to that?
I'm kind of looking around going, "Fellas, there's no cameras here. Like, there's nobody here." I mean, the best dressed people in this building are the coaches, and that's only because they tuck their shirts in. Like, that's it. Like, we've kind of got to embrace all this.
I have flip-flops on right now. I have seen pictures of you wearing flip-flops.
Yes.
So I haven't been comfortable going there yet.
I only don't wear flip-flops because of the amount of walking you kind of have to do,
and
then less comfortable than wearing sneakers. But I have no problem with the aesthetics of right. flip-flops down here. Right. I'm telling you. By the time you get to the last day, you'll be wearing like a cutoff t-shirt, jeans with mustard stains on them, and you know.
I need to buy some new. I'm going to jump on Amazon, which, by the way, I've learned quickly. The longer you're here, I'm just shipping stuff to myself.
Oh yeah, I've done that a dozen times.
So I have some headphones showing up today. I'm very excited. Right after this, I'm going to get them. But I need some more creative t-shirts. If I'm going to go the t-shirt route, you know, I need to have a little fun and do some purchasing on that front. But this world's crazy, man. I mean, it's tiring, but it is like summer league on steroids.
Yeah.
The access is fascinating. The games are entertaining. So
access has been good. I mean, it's I wanted to be here early because of the 22 teams, and I could write Devin Booker, I could write Damian Lillard, what he did. But even now, like, there's only a handful of us here. So you can, I mean, you got to Jimmy Butler as soon as you got here. Like, there's ways to do it. And I think that's what I'll miss most of all. Our friend Ben Golliver is writing a book about this experience, and I look forward to reading it because I think it's really been. Yeah, you hate to say like once in a lifetime, but it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's once in a lifetime type of stuff.
So, I agree. Yeah, we'll see. Historic. All right, brother. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it, man.